Okay, good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here and pleasure to see you all. It's not a pleasure to discuss necessarily what we're going to be discussing this morning, but then again, as Rabbi Price mentioned, our goal this morning is to try to find some meaningful insight into the time that we find ourselves this year and hopefully walk away with something which will be helpful to enable us to properly experience this difficult time of year on the Jewish calendar. I'd like to begin by relating an incident which occurred in my life not all that long ago. A number of years ago, I spent my summers working in a Jewish sleepaway camp in the Catskills. My wife and I attended that camp for about 6 or 7 years. And the camp actually bordered on another camp, which was not an observant camp. It was officially a Jewish camp, and I believe they served kosher food. And there was Sabbath observance on some level, but there were differences between the camp in which we had been staying and this neighboring camp. And what happened was, I remember that it was on Tisha B'Av, probably about 5, 6, 7 years ago. And the entire camp where I had been gathered to recite Eicha on the night of Tisha B'Av. And obviously, as you know, that is one of the saddest times of year. We dim the lights and everybody sits on the floor. And it's a time of mourning and reflection, and everybody is silent, and we encourage the kids not really to engage in any other conversations or idle chatter and the like. And we sat there and we began to recite Eicha. And then what happened was we heard, not from all that far away, because again this neighboring camp was literally a stone's throw away, that they had started playing very loud music. And it was disco music, and it was getting louder and louder and louder, and we heard a lot of the kids gathering to the center of the camp, and suddenly an announcement was made on the loudspeaker. They said, "We'd like to welcome everyone and invite you to attend the annual Tisha B'Av disco." Right? And we all heard this in the camp. So here we're trying to get the kids to be, you know, quiet and serious and calm. And all of a sudden, a few feet away, they were having a Tisha B'Av disco. So we were obviously completely beside ourselves. All the kids were laughing, and whatever mood we were able to create was completely gone. But I was very perplexed. I couldn't believe that. I'd never heard of anything such a disco I've heard of, and Tisha B'Av I've heard of. A Hanukkah disco, okay. I've never attended one, but I could hear. A Purim disco, yes. But a Tisha B'Av, it didn't make any sense to me. Later on that day, I made my way over to the neighboring camp, and the opportunity to ask a number of the people who had worked there, who we had interacted with on a number of different levels throughout the summer, what's going on? I never heard of such a thing, a Tisha B'Av disco. It would be one thing if you wouldn't want to observe Tisha B'Av at all, that's fine, but please explain to me a Tisha B'Av disco. And he said, well, the truth of the matter is, from our perspective, for hundreds and thousands of years, the Jews were mourning. They were mourning the destruction of the temple. They were mourning persecution. They were mourning the lack of religious freedom, the fact that we couldn't worship our God the way we wanted, where we wanted, how we wanted. And suddenly, over the past few generations, we've seen a complete turnaround. Following the very, very dark period in Jewish history of the Holocaust, we've seen the establishment of the State of Israel. We've seen the return of the Jews to Israel. We've seen the reunification of the city of Jerusalem. It seems that there's a lot to celebrate. And in fact, they said, there's really not all that much missing. And he went on to say, the truth of the matter is, you do the same. And I said, what do you mean? He said, each and every year, after Tisha B'Av, the first Shabbos is called Shabbat Nachamu. Shabbos Nachamu. And traditionally, in many Jewish settings and in all the religious Jewish camps in the Catskills, on the Saturday night of Shabbos Nachamu, they have a big celebration. It's called a Malava Malko, or they have a concert. They'll have some. And a similar event takes place. Sometimes that event takes place 1 or 2 days after Tisha B'Av. If Tisha B'Av falls out on a Thursday, so less than 2 days later already, you're celebrating. You're having a concert, everybody's singing and dancing. So you yourselves admit that obviously there's not all that much to mourn about because you're celebrating yourselves. So we just figured we would do it on the day of Tisha B'Av itself because we don't really think that there really is that much to mourn. And I said, touche. You had me. I wasn't prepared for such an intelligent response. And the truth of the matter is, I walked back to the camp thinking to myself, That's a pretty, you raised a very, very good point. How is it that we just stand up 1, 2, 3 days after Tisha B'Av and start celebrating? We say, Nachamu, Nachamu Ami, which comes from the words of the prophet that essentially God is saying to the Jewish people, I will console you. And you will be consoled. And where is the consolation after such a very, very difficult time of sadness and of mourning? And I'd like to share a perspective with you today, which will enable us, I believe, not only to appreciate the consolation, which, please God, we will be able to experience, but even to be able to put our mourning into a certain context as well. We are now really towards the beginning of the period of time known as the 3 weeks. And in order to properly experience and gain and benefit from the mourning of Tisha B'Av, it requires preparation in advance. Nobody wants to mourn. Nobody wants to be sad. But this is a very, very important part of the Jewish experience. It's a very important time. It's a very important part of our overall appreciation of who we are as a people and where we are headed. And I think that if we begin to put in perspective at this point the mourning of Tisha B'Av and even the consolation that follows, it will make the entire experience more worthwhile. The approach that I'm going to take begins with a Mishnah, which comes from the Tractate of Sukkah. Now, Sukkot is the farthest thing from our mind. I believe a year ago when I spoke to Jaeli, we spoke about Sukkot at that time. We're not talking about Sukkot right now, but the way our Torah works, it's beautiful the way so many different concepts and ideas are interconnected and related one with another. And the Mishnah in Sukkot tells us something very interesting. We know that on Sukkot we have the practice of taking the four species, the lulav and the esrog, the hadassim and the aravos, and we take them. Does anyone know, I don't want to put anyone on the spot, does anyone know how many days over the course of Sukkot we actually take the lulav and esrog together?
Seven.
It's seven, correct. Now, what's interesting is that if you look in the Torah and try to identify the source for this mitzvah, you'll find that the Torah introduces this mitzvah really essentially in one place, in Parshat Emor, and there the Torah tells us, "Ulekachtem lachem bayom harishon," that the lulav and esrog are to be taken on the first day, not on the second day, not on the third day, not on the fourth, fifth, sixth, or seventh, but on the first day of Sukkot. So the commandment to take the four species is only on the first day of Sukkot. So why is it, and you are correct, that we actually take the four species for 7 days? So the truth is, if you keep on reading, the Torah tells us you take these species on the fourth day, on the first day. However, usmachtem lifnei Hashem Elokeichem shivat yamim, which means that you should rejoice with these species before God for 7 days. What does that mean? It says you take it for 1 day, but you will rejoice with them before God for 7 days. So what this means is as follows, that everywhere in the world, in Israel, not in the land of Israel, in America, in Argentina, in South Africa, everywhere, on a Torah level, as far as the Torah is concerned, we take the lulav and esrog for 1 day. The Torah tells us that in the Beis HaMikdash itself, that in the temple, it's to be taken for 7 days. When it says in the Torah, Lifnei Hashem, before God, so, yeah, we are before God right now. I'm not going to deny, not only because of the fact we're sitting in a shul, but even if we'd be outside in the street, we're also before God. But there are different levels of before God. And when you're standing in the temple itself in Jerusalem, that is really before God. And there the Torah tells us you take these seven species for how many? For 7 days. So wait a second, why is it in Teaneck, New Jersey, today, this coming Sukkot, hopefully we'll all be in Jerusalem, but in case some of us will still be here, why is it that we will be taking the lulav and esrog for 7 days? This isn't the temple. Let's not kid ourselves. Not only that, there is no temple. Even Jerusalem, there's no temple. So why are we taking it for 7 days? Does anyone know the answer? The answer is to remember the temple when it stood. That following the destruction of the temple, so there was a man by the name of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, a great sage, and Rabbi Yochanan said, we must institute certain practices, certain elements of behavior, which will remind the people of what life was like when the temple stood. And so therefore, if you look in the Torah, it says you take the lulav and esrog for one day. But we take it for 7 days. Why? The Hebrew term for this is a zecher lamikdash. It's to remember the temple. And the truth of the matter is, you may be able on your own to identify other practices that we have throughout the year, which are also considered a zecher lamikdash. Can anyone think of any? That phrase, zecher lamikdash, may ring a bell in some minds. I'll give you a hint. Pesach. I'm sorry? Ah, very interesting. Okay, troublemaker. We're going to get there in a moment. We're not up to the ashes. You're right. We're going to discuss ashes, but I want to leave that aside for a moment.
The matzah on the first day and you eat it 7 days.
Well, that's interesting. Actually, the Torah tells us...
7 days.
Well, the Torah says one to eat the first night, and then also to eat 7 days. So there may be a mitzvah, actually, even on a Torah level, to eat matzah for 7 days of Pesach. But you're right that it is connected to matzah. At the Pesach Seder, you may recall, after we drink 2 cups of wine and we're ready to plotch, we then go ahead and we eat matzah. And then, you know, our stomachs have really had. And then, just in case you're still standing, you take some maror. And then after that, we make a sandwich. Right? It's not necessarily as good as corned beef on rye, but we take a sandwich. We call it the korech sandwich. And what we say when we eat the sandwich is zecher lemikdash kehila. Zecher lemikdash, that same term. We are doing this, why? Not because it's really a real commandment to do so, but we're remembering that when the mikdash stood, they actually made a sandwich. They took the korban pesach. The best part of that sandwich was missing, by the way. I joked about corned beef and rye. The best part of that sandwich is what? The lamb chops. All right, so that's another reason why we should want the Beis HaMikdash to be rebuilt. I mean, that sandwich will be, please God, much tastier one day. But it used to have some meat in there. That's the concept of a Zecher LeMikdash. We count Sfiras Omer, the 49 days that we count in between Pesach and Shavuot. That is also, according to most commentaries, a Zecher LeMikdash, meaning, for reasons that I don't want to get into right now, we may not be obligated on a Torah level to perform that mitzvah today. However, we do it anyway to remember that which was when the temple stood. Now, the Gemara, the Talmud, asks a very interesting question. The Talmud asks, in that Gemara and Sukkah, the Mishnah and Sukkah that I mentioned a moment ago, Minolon da'avdinan zecher lemikdash, which means, how do we know that we make a Zecher LeMikdash? Who said? With all respect to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, he's a nice guy, but who's Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai to say that we make a Zecher LeMikdash? After all, maybe the temple is destroyed. Live with it. There is no temple. Stop living in a dream world. Stop kidding yourself. Stop pretending as if the Mikdash stands. It's been destroyed. So we know, how do we know that we actually make a Zecher LeMikdash? Ask the Gemara. And the Gemara quotes a pasuk from the prophet Jeremiah, Yirmiyahu. I'll read it to you in Hebrew, and then I'll translate it. The pasuk in Hebrew is, Ki aleh arucha lach, which means, I will make a cure for you, says God. U'mimakosayich erpa'ech ne'um Hashem, and I will heal you from your wounds, so says God. Ki, why? Nidacha karulach, because they have called you discarded. Your enemies have said, you're nothing. Tzion hi doresh ein la, saying, she is Zion, no one cares about her. The most important part of this phrase are those last words where the pasuk, the verse in Jeremiah says, Sion hi doresh ein la, very depressing pasuk, which means she is Zion and no one cares about her. No one thinks about her. She's been forgotten. So says Rabbi Yochanan, doresh ein la. The prophet is lamenting the fact that nobody remembers Sion. So we see from here the Bayit Risha, that we must remember her. The fact that Yirmiyahu, that Jeremiah is lamenting the fact that no one remembers Tzion, that reminds us that we must remember Zion. We must remember Yerushalayim. We must remember the temple. So says the Gemara, we remember the temple because of this pasuk of Tzionhi, Darei Sheinla, that we have to remember the temple when she stood. Now I have 2 questions, and I'll take your answers, and then I'll suggest one of my own, unless you can answer yourself. Question number one is, why does the Gemara even ask the question, why do we make a Zecher LeMikdash? Why do we remember the temple? Isn't that a strange question? The temple was the most important part of Jewish life when it stood. It was the center, it was the nucleus of the entire universe, our rabbis teach us, but certainly the entire Jewish community. It was where people came three times a year from far and wide to literally meet God, to be able to experience God and His providence in a way that was not experienceable or perceivable in other places of the world. It was the most important part of our life. But yet the Talmud asks, well, how do we know that we're supposed to do anything to remember it? Isn't that a strange question? You know what that's like saying, if a person, God forbid, has a loved one who they cherish and love more than anything in the world, and then that person passes away. Naturally, tragically, the person is gone. And the one who is surviving, who is left here, tries to do certain things to remember that person. Maybe they'll wear a piece of jewelry that this person wore. Maybe they'll from time to time take out pictures. So would you have the nerve to go over to such a person and say, why are you doing that? Why are you trying to remember that person? Of course, the answer is obvious. Because this person was the most important person in my life, and I miss her, I miss him. And so therefore, I try to do anything to latch on to him, to latch on to her. It's the same thing here. Why is the Talmud even asking, how do we know we make a Zecher LeMikdash? How do we know we do anything to remember the temple? Of course we're going to remember the temple. We're going to forget her. And I have a second question. And the second question is that the concept of remembering the temple is not a new concept. The Gemara and Sukkah that I just quoted to you seems to imply that this is the first time I've ever heard of this idea. But the truth of the matter is, and this is where I'm going to get back to what you said about the ashes, the truth of the matter is, the Talmud elsewhere in Tractate Bava Basra teaches the following, that when a person constructs a new home, they should try to leave a little bit, we're not going to get into the details of this right now, and if it applies and when it applies and how it applies, but you'll take it at face value and be happy to take questions afterwards to discuss particulars. When a person builds a new home, they are supposed to build it, but leave a little part unfinished. Why? Because of a zecher, to remember the destruction of the temple. When a person puts together a lavish feast, says the Talmud, they should leave a little bit missing. Whether you leave something off the table, whether you take out a course. When a person has a very, very special celebration, there should be a zecher. There should be a remembrance of the temple. Says the Talmud, when a woman adorns herself with all sorts of jewelry and gets dressed up for a special occasion, she should leave something out. Many in our generation have accepted this because they wear one earring. So I guess they that's a zecher l'korban. Right? They don't want to wear two, so they take out one. But when a person, again, is celebrating a very, very special moment in life, so they leave something off. It shouldn't be complete. Our simcha is not complete. Now the Gemara, the Talmud goes on similarly, how do we know this is true? So says the Gemara quotes a pasuk. And this pasuk may be familiar, more familiar to some of you. This pasuk comes from Psalms, from Tehillim. In Hebrew, Im ishkachech Yerushalayim tishkach imini, which means literally, if I forget you, Yerushalayim, so I should forget my right hand. That my tongue should stick to my palate. In other words, I wish upon myself curses if I should ever forget Jerusalem. And the Gemara actually goes on to say that's exactly why when a groom stands under the canopy at his wedding, so what the custom is to this very day, we take some ashes and we place them on his head, right in the place where the tefillin go. And it's a special moment, it's a happy moment, hopefully the happiest moment of his life. But we remind him, even at such a time, that we are missing something very important. So my question is, why does the Gemara in Sukkah question, where does Zecher LeMikdash come from? We already have a source for it, and not only that, there's a different verse that's quoted. Now, it's here that I want to sensitize you to something that I'm sure all of you know. But every word of our Torah, and not only our Torah Shebichtav, written law, but our oral law as well, is sacred. And when our rabbis go out of their way to cite two verses, that means that there was something incomplete, there was something wrong with the, so to speak, with the first verse. We're not going to just cite two verses because for the purpose of emphasis. We, when we learn our Torah, focus and pay very, very close attention to every single word that we find. And when we find one statement in the Talmud which says we remember the Mikdash because of Tzion hi dorei shenla, because of that pasuk which says we must remember Zion, and then we find another statement in the Talmud which says we remember Jerusalem. Why? Because of a different verse in Eskachech Yerushalayim, so we have to stop and say why. It can't just be that the rabbis, oh, they forgot that one, so they said, oh, they forgot. No. There must be something going on here. There must be something deeper. There must be a reason why two verses are needed. And there must be a reason why, in one place, the rabbis ponder, why do we have a Zeichel HaMikdash? And in the other case, the question goes completely unasked. So I offer it to the audience if you have any suggestions. Again, to reiterate, why are two verses needed as opposed to one to teach this as the idea of a Zeichel HaMikdash? Why is it that when the rabbis teach us that we take something out of our meals and the woman leaves out a piece of jewelry, and when we build a house, we don't complete it? So there, the rabbis don't ask, how do we know that's so? They accept that as a fact. But when we say that we carry the lulav and esrog for 7 days, and when we have the korich sandwich at the table, and when we count the sfiras ha'omer, this is all of it. So there, the Gemara says, why? How do you know? How do you know you do that? There seem to be some obvious inconsistencies between these two sources. Yes?
Well, just as a thought, with some of the mitzvot, like the Amalek, there's a positive commandment, there's a negative commandment. You should remember and you should never forget. There are two
very interesting
commandments on one thought.
So right.
You must remember, but you must never forget are two different concepts.
That's very interesting. So you're saying that one of these is to remember, the other one is not to forget. Right, that's interesting, because actually, you know, the verse in Tehillim says, "In eschachech Yerushalayim," that right, I shall never forget Jerusalem, and the other one we're saying is this concept of being doresh, of positively remembering. That's a very interesting approach, and we'll see. The thought that we're going to introduce in a moment may very, very much be reflective of that idea that you just expressed. It's a very nice thought.
What about similar to Shabbos, you know, keep and remember?
Mm-hmm.
You know, one thing is to remember it, another thing is to actively, you know, seek to rebuild it when the time is right.
Right, so very interesting. So there as well we have this sort of dual responsibility. One is called Zachor, to remember. We recite Kiddush, we recite Havdalah, perhaps we light candles. We do certain activities to create a certain atmosphere of sanctity. But then there's also Shamor, to observe it, not to engage in certain acts of work, etc.
Why don't we study the sacrifices too?
That's right.
The benefit of it coming back.
And we try to remember that as well. Okay, very interesting. So both of you are pointing out correctly that we have other models within Jewish observance where we have two aspects which work, complement each other, whether it's the remembering and not forgetting, or it's the observance in a positive sense and in the negative sense when it comes to Shabbos as well. Right, so even within Kiddush itself we have this idea of remembering. Very good. Okay, very nice. So the truth of the matter is, what you've done is you've really set me up. Because now, based on these three ideas that you have offered, I'm now going to share with you a perspective which was offered by the late Rabbi Soloveitchik, may he rest in peace, who was, as many of you know, a truly great leader in the past generation. And Rabbi Soloveitchik pointed out a concept and introduced a concept which I believe not only answers these questions, as you'll see in a moment, but really offers us a very healthy perspective in terms of our observance this time of year. Rabbi Soloveitchik basically said that there are two different types of remembering. There are two different ways to remember. And in halacha, in Jewish law, we have two ways to remember the temple. One is what we call a zecher l'churban, which literally means remembering the destruction. And then there's another thing which is called a zecher l'mikdash, which means remembering the temple when it stood. And they are not the same. We would sometimes confuse the two, and until Rabbi Soloveitchik introduced this, it could be for centuries people did confuse the two. I'm not saying that no one else thought of this before, but it clarifies this issue immensely. The Gemara in Baba Basra, the second source that we quoted, is talking about a Zeichel HaChorban. The Gemara is teaching that when you experience happy occasions in life, don't forget the temple. The verse clearly says you shall never forget Jerusalem. So when you're celebrating it at your wedding, don't forget that as happy as you are, there's something important that's missing. When you are building a new house and you're exhilarated at that moment of accomplishment, don't forget. There's something very, very key and essential which is missing from your life. When you get all dressed up and you look all beautiful and you're ready, you must stop and remember, you know what? As great as I feel right now, there is something very important in my life which is missing. That, said Rabbi Soloveitchik, is a given. For that, the rabbis don't ask, how do you know you do that? Of course we do that. Of course. Is it conceivable that a Jew could live in any day and age and know about the temple and all that it stood for and not miss it? Is it conceivable that a bride and a groom could celebrate at the wedding and not mention the fact that the temple is missing? That is inconceivable. For that, the rabbis don't even ask, how do you know? Of course that's so. However, what bothered the rabbis and what they questioned was, how do you know that you have a Zecher LeMikdash? A Zecher LeMikdash is remembering not the destruction of the temple, but remembering the temple when it stood. How do we know that even now, that there's so much missing from our lives, we are still obligated to remember the glory of the Mikdash, the temple in our heyday, the beauty, our glorious past? For that, the rabbi said, how do you, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, know that that's what we do? And then he quotes a verse, a different verse. Not that we remember the destruction of Jerusalem, but remember the glory of Jerusalem. We remember the beauty of the temple. And Rabbi Soloveitchik said that one, to properly mourn and to properly remember Jerusalem and temple, must have both of these concepts in mind. On the one hand, we remember the destruction, and we are saddened all throughout the year, and especially this time of the year, at the destruction, the loss of life, the loss of potential, the destruction not merely of a building. Our rabbis clearly say that it was not that merely that the temple was a beautiful building that we mourn. Each and every one of us are still shaken and shattered by that image of the World Trade Center coming down because of the glory, if you will, and the majesty of those two unimaginable towers. But when it came to the temple, it wasn't merely that was one of the most beautiful, if not the most beautiful edifice in the world at the time. No. It's what it represented, that it housed the glory of God, that people could come from far and wide and experience God on a level. So that is something that we must remember as well. Not only the destruction, but we must remember the Mikdash, the temple, in her glory. Yes?
To help remember, as you pointed out, we use the term Yerushalayim Shel Zahav.
Very nice. And as we refer to Jerusalem not as a destroyed city and not as a barren city, but now especially in our generation as a glorious city, as a golden city. Very nice. I have, when I heard this thought, what brought to mind was relatives that I have that live in Jerusalem. And they're older. They're one or really two generations before me. Both husband and wife are survivors of the Holocaust, lost most of their family in the war. And I remember when I was learning for some time in Eretz Yisrael, so I would visit them rather frequently because they were at the time among my only relatives in Israel. And I got close with them. And they had certain practices which were clearly noticeable, which reminded me each and every time I was there that they were survivors. For example, the woman in the household, she should live and be well, would never, ever, ever throw out a piece of food. And literally, crumbs of bread would be gathered and would be put together in what she would call a challah kugel, and she would use it. She would not recycle it, but she would not let it go to waste. And there were other examples, so I won't get into right now, but clearly they walked around every day of their life with the clear, stark memories and images of the horror that they experienced. And myself at the time being curious and interested and wanting to get as much as I can from who they were and what they had experienced, I would ask them about, gently and respectfully, I would ask them to share with me when they were able to, the experiences that they had. And they would always insist on talking about the happy times. They were not interested in talking about the darkest hours. They wanted to talk about life beforehand, what they remember. They wanted to talk about their memories of a Pesach Seder with their family still intact. And to me, what I understand from this experience and from what they were sharing with me is that very often we focus too much on the Zecher l'Churban. And don't misunderstand me for a moment. We must never, ever forget the Churban of the Holocaust. And we must have that in our minds all the time. And never forget the evil and the horror and the darkness. But we also can't forget the glory which was there beforehand. The millions of people that walked the earth beforehand and led very honorable lives. And to a certain extent, the concept of a Zecher l'Churban and Zecher l'Mikdash are really the same. We remember the destruction because we have to. We can't forget how immense that suffering was. But then again, we have to remember the beauty as well. And the truth of the matter is, you can apply this model to so many areas in life. We find ourselves right now at a very difficult time in Jewish history. And everything being relative, and certainly we've come so far, and we have so much to be proud and thankful for as citizens in the country that allow us to worship our God, the fact that we can sit here in broad daylight and we don't have to whisper, and we proudly bear our signs and our heritage on our doors and on our windows. So that's something that we shouldn't take for granted, and we should be proud of. But at the same time, it's difficult. It's difficult to see the rise in terror all throughout the world, and for us especially to see what has gone on in Eretz Yisrael. Thousands of Jews who have been murdered in cold blood over the past few years alone in the land of Israel, which was supposed to be a haven, which was supposed to be finally a place of safety for people who had been suffering and persecuted for countless centuries. We find ourselves now, a few weeks before this proposed disengagement, whether you agree, you don't agree, and we're not going to get into the politics at all, but everybody here, I'm sure, is feeling very saddened by the fact that we have to do this, if you think that that's what we need to do. So either you disagree with it, or you agree with it. But the fact that the Jews are going to be uprooted from their homes, and synagogues are going to be destroyed, and cemeteries are going to have to be undug and bodies reinterred, it's frightening. And all in the land of Israel. There's a lot to be sad for. But I think that we as Jews must always balance our emotions in this regard. And we have to remember, you know what? It's true. We're at a very, very difficult point in Jewish history, and that which is going on in the land of Israel right now is difficult for us to see and observe. But then again, there's so much to be proud of. 2 weeks ago yesterday, 2 weeks ago yesterday, my wife and I went to Kennedy Airport, this time of the day. And we personally were there to say goodbye to a plane load of people who were making Aliyah. And that was actually a historic day, because at the same time there was a plane leaving Canada, and if you had heard about this, fine, and if not, you should just know that 2 weeks ago today was the largest mass immigration of North American Jewry in the state's history. There were approximately, 600-700 people who had made Aliyah on that one day. And this was all through the organization of Nefesh B'Nefesh. But I stood there, and literally with tears flowing down our eyes, we heard the founder of the organization, a close friend of mine, get up and recite the brach of Shechayanu v'kimanu v'giyanu l'azman hazeh, how thankful we are to have arrived at this occasion where we could witness hundreds of Americans who are freely, willingly, not because they're being chased, but because they want to get up and give up many of the luxuries of America and move and settle in the land of Israel, the land of our destiny, the land of our future. And at that moment of time, I could not think about disengagement. I could not think about terrorists in Israel. They didn't exist. All I saw before me was an awesome sight of sacrifice and of dedication, of commitment. It was beautiful. And this is a Zecher l'Mikdash. This is not a Zecher l'Churban. This is remembering the glory of the Jewish people, and it's remembering the glory of our future. And I think that we need to keep both of these perspectives in mind at the same time. The reason that we can celebrate right after Tisha B'Av, as the people in this camp pointed out to me, what are you having a concert for, is because we have both of these images in our mind at the same time. We can celebrate because we remember not only the destruction, which we certainly mark and commemorate and focus on, leading up to and certainly on the day of Tisha B'Av itself. That is the mourning of the destruction. Not only the temple itself, but all the destruction throughout Jewish history. And believe me, as you know, one day is not enough, one week is not enough, one year is not enough to commemorate and to observe properly the destruction throughout Jewish history. What happens afterwards, it's not a game. It's not that we say, okay, you know, the morning's over, now let's celebrate. We're celebrating because we realize, despite the fact that we've been through hell again and again and again and again, we are here. We are thriving as a nation. We are striving for always for things to be better. But there's so much that we have to be proud of. I'm not going to deny the fact that there is, in America today, well over a 50% intermarriage rate. That in 2 years, they say, the Jewish population in Israel will be the largest Jewish population in the world, even greater than America. Not because thousands and thousands and thousands of people are making aliyah, but because thousands and thousands and thousands of people are giving up their Jewish identity. I'm not going to deny that. I'm not naive. I'm not living in a bubble. I know what's going on out there. But I also know what's going on inside this room. I know what's going on in many other places in the world. And we don't measure success merely by numbers. Quality of experience in Jewish life and in the world today is important for us to consider as well. And there's a lot to be proud of, because despite the tremendous draws and pull of the culture around us, and despite the awesome challenges that parents face today, raising their kids in a world which is very misguided, and for the most part, very morally corrupt, despite all that, we have a lot to be proud of. We've accomplished a lot, and there are more Jews, get ready for this, I'm not making this up, hold on to your seatbelts for this, there are more Jews sitting and learning Torah today on a regular basis than perhaps ever before in all of Jewish history. Because even in our greatest day, people were not as devoted to Jewish texts in the sense of sitting in yeshiva and in kollel as they are today. And I'm not saying that's where we should all be or that's the ideal. Take it just at face value. Despite all that we've been through, we've come very far. I don't want to embarrass anyone, so I'm not going to point out any names in particular, but there is an individual in this room right now who survived the Holocaust and who lived through a very, very difficult time in which he lost members of his own family. And he had the zechus this past year of going to Eretz Yisrael and being there with his grandson, who was inducted into Tzahal, into the Israeli army. I mean, despite I don't want to focus on the personal nachas that he had, because it's not my place to comment. You understand what that means? This is a person who witnessed that which appeared perhaps from that time to be the annihilation, the successful annihilation of the Jewish people. And here, he was there with his grandson, you know, to experience our continuity, our survival, and our commitment. I mean, we must have both images in mind at the same time. We must remember the Churban, but we must remember the Mikdash as well. And I'd like to conclude by just making one final point, and then if you have any questions, certainly you can ask. And that is that our rabbis point out that there is a link. There is a link between Tisha B'Av and Rosh Hashanah. That's strange, because although really the next significant day on the Jewish calendar is Rosh Hashanah, other than that fact, I would have thought the 2 days are completely unrelated. But our rabbis call, anybody know how much time there is between Tisha B'Av and, I'm sorry? No, not far, not pretty close, 7 weeks, actually you're right. And you're right, it's 70 days, it's 7 weeks. There are 7 weeks, correct. You forgive me, I never thought of it in terms of dates. There are 7 weeks in between Tisha B'Av and Rosh Hashanah. Yeah, okay. Well, I'm certainly not, so good. I'm sorry?
Not a mathematician, though.
Okay. 7 weeks, that which our rabbis call the Shiva de Nechemta, the 7 weeks of consolation, which link Tisha B'Av and Rosh Hashanah. Now, again, other than the fact that it's a cute way of remembering how much time left until we dip the apple in the honey, what is the connection between Tisha B'Av and Rosh Hashanah? And I believe, based on our perspective, the answer is really the same. Rosh Hashanah is a time for repentance, for tshuva. And very often when people engage in tshuva, so they focus on the negative. They take out, hopefully, they should, a laundry list. And it should be a lengthy list, if we're honest with ourselves, of areas in my life where I have failed to live up to my potential, where I have failed to really, really be the person that I could be. To be the wife that I could be, the husband that I could be, the parent that I could be, the child that I could be the Jew that I could be. And if a person is honest and committed to repenting, so they will have a very, very lengthy list of areas that they can improve. That's what we'll call, for example, the Zeicha L'Churban, remembering the destruction of my life. However, if a person wants to be a Baal Tshuva, and I can only speak for myself, I can't speak for you, I want to be a Baal Tshuva, I want to be able to say that after Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, I have been able to bring myself back and closer to God, so the person must remember as well all of his and her accomplishments. They have to remember all that they did. They have to remember the successes that they've had, again, as a husband, as a wife, as a family member, as a Jew. Because if I'm just going to berate myself and I'm just going to say I've done this wrong and this wrong and this wrong and this wrong and not remember all that I've accomplished, it's going to be a self-defeating process and a person will not survive and will not really maximize all that time of the year has to offer. Being a real sincere Baal Tshuva means remembering and constantly thinking about all that I've done and how I can increase that and how I can improve in the areas that I've been successful, and as well to be honest and identify those areas of my life which I need to improve in. And this is really the same concept of mourning and consolation. I mourn because things have gone wrong and there have been dark periods in my life and dark periods in Jewish history, but I'm consoled by the images of what was and the anticipation of the restoration of those images, knowing of course that in the right time soon we will see that the fulfillment of many, many of the prophecies of our people and our prophets. I'd like to conclude by stating that I'm not a prophet. That's not a secret to anyone here. I don't know whether Mashiach will come tomorrow, or in a month from now, or in a year from now, or in 10 years from now. But I think everyone here realizes that we're close. We're close in the big picture from observing the many, many centuries of Jewish history and seeing what has unfolded before our eyes. And I'm probably the youngest in the room, but even before my eyes, over the past 30, 40, 50 years in the world around us, and with the increase, unfortunately, in sadness and in terror and in death in the world, we're definitely moving closer. And it really behooves us, it's our responsibility to prepare for the ultimate redemption by remembering again not only the destruction, not only the sadness, and not only the mourning, but to remember as well the beauty of the temple, the beauty of the style of life that we had when everyone was clearly aware and cognizant of the existence of God and the role that God played in our lives, and our yearning for the return of that state of perfection for the world and for the Jewish community. And I hope and pray that this coming Tisha B'Av, we won't sit on the floor. Right now, the way things are scheduled, we will be reciting Eicha. We're reciting the Lamentations on the day of Tisha B'Av, sitting on the floor in mourning. But that could change. We have an email system here in the shul that we can inform people as moments beforehand that changes, that there have been changes in the schedule, and we will be all be packing our bags and going to Jerusalem. But if we once again this year have to sit on the floor, so we have to have both of these images in our mind at the same time. The Zeicha L'Churban, remembering the sadness, but then enabling ourselves to pull ourselves together, to stand up from that sadness, to remember the glory of the past, and to dream once again for a glorious future. Thank you very much for your participation, your attention.
Kids gives us power.